Race to the Pole by James Cracknell and Ben Fogle. Read by James Cracknell and Ben Fogle. A fierce wind scoured our faces, and ice snapped at our heels. The inside of my nose had frozen, and icicles were beginning to form on my eyelashes. The cold cut through to the core, and my bones ached from the chill. On we trudged. I'd long lost all feeling in my fingers, and my toes felt like ice cubes. I shook my arms furiously in an effort to get the blood flowing again. Every breath stung as the freezing air burnt my throat. I bowed my head into the wind and pushed on, straining into my harness. It was minus 40 degrees Celsius, a temperature at which even in polar clothing the body is pushed to its limit. I knew that my fingers had dropped below freezing, and if I didn't do something about it soon, I'd be in danger of losing them to frostbite. I looked across at James. His balaclava was covered in a thick layer of frost, and his legs were buckling with fatigue. We'd been going for 12 hours, and it was time to admit defeat, get inside, and warm up. Minutes later, we clambered into the tent and collapsed with exhaustion. Unzipping the door with my frozen hands had been like buttoning a shirt with an oven glove. The thin fabric gave us some protection from the wind chill, but even inside, as I struggled to light the stove, it was still minus 25. The lighter had frozen. I fumbled with a box of matches, but the stove was too cold to ignite. I started to feel the pressure of the situation. We had to get the stove alight, or we'd freeze. Not a moment too soon, the match flared into life. I held it to the shallow pool of fuel on the freezing metal, and there was a small puff as a green flame engulfed the petrol. Slowly the flame grew into a flickering orange and then a thunderous blue as the metal sighed with relief. I longed for the warmth of my sleeping bag and the escapism of dreams. I was worried about my fingers, though. They'd been numb for too long. I shook them violently, but they remained frozen like a claw. I squeezed them back into the thin contact gloves, then the outer gloves and the thick mitts. I crawled across towards the exit and once again wrestled with the door zip. Snow whirled into the tent. I needed to find some help. I needed to save my fingers. I trudged off into the cold. I lifted my hand to the metal bar, looped my arm, and tugged with my elbow. At last, the huge steel frame began to move. I was overcome by a dazzle of bright light. This is it, I thought, as I moved towards the light. I hauled with my arm against the wind, and the metal clunked behind me. Silence. The wind disappeared, and I was overcome with a warm glow. I lifted my goggles. Half a dozen faces stared at me from behind their control screens. A scientist rushed over and began stripping the small metal thermometer probes from my fingertips. "We need to warm your fingers," she said, fussing around me. "They're down below 0 degrees. I looked through the thick window at our tent, snapping in the artificial wind created by two huge industrial fans. In a giant freezer in Oxfordshire, we had had our first taste of freezing polar conditions, and I began to wonder what we'd let ourselves in for.
"What are you doing now?" That was my dreaded dinner party question when I stopped rowing after the 2004 Athens Olympics. I'd found it incredibly difficult to answer then, not because I wasn't doing anything, but because, in my mind at least, nothing sounded as worthwhile as the Olympics. After rowing across the Atlantic with Ben, the question had changed slightly. "What are you doing next?" I didn't feel under any external pressure to do something for the sake of it, but I knew I wanted to do something similar again. It wasn't just the journey and the physical and mental challenges that naturally came with it. I enjoyed the planning itself, the development and the training. I missed preparing for a long-term goal and the pressure that comes with having to perform. But though I wanted to get stuck into another big challenge, there are a number of things I had to consider. The first being my family life. The Atlantic rowing race had nearly destroyed my marriage to Bev, and for me, nothing is worth risking that. It had been a problem of communication rather than an impasse. I'd avoided talking about rowing across the Atlantic with Bev until the last possible moment, and not surprisingly, she didn't feel included in the decision-making process. I hadn't explained why I'd wanted to do the row. I wasn't even sure myself. So for Bev, when she thought we might start having a normal family life and share the responsibility